Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on optimizing ESR1 mutation detection and next-generation endocrine therapy integration in HR-positive HER2-negative breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. V.K. Gotti, Heather MacArthur, and Neil Iyengar will discuss the importance of detecting and overcoming endocrine resistance in hormone receptor-positive breast cancer to guide treatment decisions. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from Genentech, Inc., Lilly, and Stemline Therapeutics, Inc. In the first segment, Dr. Gotti gives a brief overview of ctDNA and NGS in clinical practice and explains mechanisms of resistance in breast cancer.
So I'll start with this very high-level, 10,000-foot view. There's a couple technologies available to us to find out whose cancers are just not going to listen to the things we want to do. One is ctDNA. And we can essentially now, and this gets very confusing because there's a lot of confusion around what technology to use in one context. ctDNA means a lot of different things. We now have it available as a screening tool potentially for patients who don't have a cancer diagnosis, all the way up to very specific serial monitoring in patients who have a diagnosis. So in the context of what we're talking about today, ctDNA is looking for specific mutations in actionable genes, such as ESR1 and PIK3CA. So we're going to see some of that data. Whether or not that detected mutation can be used for monitoring, et cetera, that's still open to debate, but at least it can license patients to get specific therapies. So that's one thing. And then just to make a distinction, we also still do NGS. It's something that I think a lot of providers like to do on the basic first specimen at the time of progression or the time of presentation with metastatic disease. You may pick up on other things such as tumor mutational burden or HER2 mutations, for example, so other things that might be actionable as well. So that's the diagnostic strategy. And then the other thing is to understand the mechanisms of resistance, because that actually informs what are the actual drugs we can use. So for one, this is a very old graphic from a paper that I found about 15 years ago, and I keep adding to it. But one of the canonical ways that we understand resistance can emerge is the estrogen receptor can just basically be stuck in the on position, pretending like it's bound to estrogen, and essentially find its way into the nucleus, open the chromatin, and reprogram the cancer cell in that way. An aromatase inhibitor simply starves cells of estrogen by inhibiting that terminal process of aromatization to create estrogen from pre-estrogen. In this context, that doesn't matter anymore, right? Because the estrogen receptor is stuck in the on position. So the alternative ways to do this then would be to destroy the receptor. And so you're going to see some data on a couple different methods we have available to destroy the receptor. Another thing that can happen is this idea of the PAM pathway can get activated. So PIK3CA, AKT, and mTOR, you can have mutations along that pathway, or you can even have a tyrosine kinase above it signaling through that pathway. But once this becomes active, it compromises the dependency of the cancer cells on estrogen alone. And so now we have ways to block some of those elements, and you can see some of those drugs, and we're going to see that as well today. The next, and this is an emerging area, kind of fell out of favor, it's coming back, is you can literally reprogram the chromatin by sticking methylation marks where they don't belong or histone marks where they don't belong, folding the DNA in a way that the estrogen receptor just doesn't go where it's supposed to go. We have tried very hard to use HDAC inhibitors. They didn't quite work out for us. We've tried demethylation inhibitors, a little too toxic, but there's some excitement around a new class of drugs called CAT6 inhibitors. CAT stands for lysine acetyltransferase 6, so it's another chromatin-modifying pathway. And then lastly, the cell cycle, and I won't beleaguer this too much. We know, for example, in a lot of these cancer cells, dependency on mutations or alterations in RB signaling, for example, can lead to autonomous growth even in the absence of good estrogen intact pathways. So co-blocking using CDK4/6 inhibitors, et cetera, can make a big difference. But even here, we're seeing some innovation. We're going to see an era where we have pure CDK4 inhibitors and then pan CDK inhibitors, where we're hitting novel CDKs as well as part of the cell cycle. And of course, all these things can be combined.
In the next segment, Dr. Iyengar talks about the clinical implications of resistance and how treatment strategies are evolving.
I have now the task of, in the next 5 minutes, just commenting on the importance of ESR1 as a resistance mechanism and how we identify patients who have developed or are developing ESR1 mutations in some of the trials and tribulations of our methodologies to do so. This is also the point of the weekend where my voice starts to give out, so my apologies for the hoarseness. That being said, we heard from VK about resistance mechanisms that can develop in hormone receptor positive breast cancer, and this slide, so I'll be focusing later on early breast cancer, but I think I could actually expand this to say unmet needs in metastatic as well as early breast cancer, because we know that resistance, particularly the ESR1 mutation, arises under the selective pressure of aromatase inhibition, which oftentimes happens in the adjuvant setting. This slide is depicting some of the other molecular aberrations that can occur and give rise to resistance, either as established resistance mechanisms that create or are associated with shorter duration of response to some of our therapies, as well as predictors of response to other therapies that we have available to us as well. And so essentially, this is, of course, the precision medicine paradigm where we try to understand which of these resistance mechanisms we can either predict for and maybe circumvent or intervene early, although that, of course, is an evolving area of investigation, or target upfront to improve long-term outcomes. So let's focus specifically on ESR1 alterations as a resistance mechanism here. And as we heard from VK, that there are several extracellular and intracellular cellular pathways that are, of course, regulated by the estrogen receptor during or with the presence of an ESR1 mutation. The estrogen receptor, takes on a conformation that is constitutively activated. So you can see in the schematic there several of the hotspot mutations in the binding pocket of the estrogen receptor that lead to this constituent activation, thereby rendering the need for the ligand unnecessary. In other words, estrogen-independent activation. And so overcoming this ESR1 alteration, or essentially the constituent activation of the estrogen receptor, is a key area of study for overcoming endocrine resistance, or at least perpetuating endocrine therapy sensitivity. When we look at outcomes in patients who do develop ESR1 mutations, we do see that outcomes are worse, as you can see in the Kaplan-Meier curves there. Those are data summarizing patients who received aromatase inhibitors as their subsequent therapies after the identification of an ESR1 mutation in the blue line, and you can see that those outcomes are worse than patients with ESR1 wild-type tumors. In the table on the right, this is sort of older data, if you will, Paloma 3 as well as Bolero 2 and so forth. But what I think is interesting here is if you look at median PFS in the ESR1 mutated population versus wild type population, of course it is lower. But interestingly, if you look at fulvestrant monotherapy, we do think that fulvestrant has some activity in the setting of an ESR1 mutation. It's really not that great. There you can see that the reduction or the relative reduction in activity, at least in median PFS, is similar to trials that used molecular therapy partners as well. So this slide sort of summarizes that problem with fulvestrant, and we think that some of the reasons why fulvestrant may be limited in general, but also particularly in the setting of an ESR1 mutation, is partly due to its pharmacokinetics. It is, of course, delivered intramuscularly, as we all know, but this may limit the amount of drug or the therapeutic distribution of the drug to overcome that constituently activated estrogen receptor. We also know that there are other problems in terms of patient care with regard to the discomfort of the administration and so forth. So ultimately, the development of the oral SERDs has really been geared at overcoming that ESR1 induced resistance, but also to improve the experience and delivery of the drug itself, and finally to rely on perhaps better PK to deliver better dose intensity of the SERD. So let's just take a look at some data, and I showed this slide if you were at the Crossfire session yesterday. I showed this slide as well because I think it's important that we keep in mind the concordance rates in circulating tumor DNA or liquid biopsies versus tissue biopsies, because certainly in the early stage setting, we're typically relying on MRD assays or circulating or ctDNA assays to identify resistance mechanisms, although we can debate, and I think we will debate, whether how often we're using MRD assays in the early stage setting. But data in the metastatic setting indicates not only a good concordance rate between circulating assays and tissue biopsies for identifying actionable mutations like the ESR1 mutation, but also suggests that you might actually have a higher yield of identifying these mutations with circulating tumor DNA, perhaps due to a greater sample and also accounting for tumor heterogeneity, which circulating assays account for. Now, this is the MSK impact and MSK access data, which I also showed yesterday, but I'm going to take a different perspective on it today, because thinking about that early stage setting, one of the unique things about the Sloan Kettering biobank is that a portion of these patients actually had early stage disease, and sequencing was done on primary tumors as well as, so that's the MSK impact assay. The MSK access assay is the ctDNA assay. And essentially, in a cohort that includes predominantly metastatic disease, but also a fairly good representation of early stage disease, you again see that good concordance between the tissue and circulating assays as well, suggesting that even in primary disease, circulating assays may be useful for identifying target mutations and resistance mutations. Now, in the early stage setting and also in the upfront metastatic setting, circulating assays allow for serial assessment, of course, to identify the emergence of resistance mutations and really to better understand the landscape of clonal dynamics. And so this is, I think, where the potential of this technology is perhaps the most promising. The question is, when do we intervene? And we have data from several trials now that are starting to address this, but there are challenges as well. And we saw that challenge in the SERENA-6 trial with the number needed to treat, if you will, in terms of the number of patients that were screened to identify an emergent ESR1 mutation. And there you can see that less than 10% of patients who were screened were ultimately randomized, were found to have an ESR1 mutation, and then randomized. So I think one of the challenges is how do we optimize use of the circulating assays in a way that's efficient and effective. And then the other issue that we are dealing with, not only in the metastatic setting, but in the early stage setting, is the sensitivity of these assays and the time and when to escalate therapy as well. All right, so my task was to go over about 10 trials in the next 8 minutes. So this is going to be really challenging, but we'll condense it all down into sort of high-level summary. And that really tells us how rapidly the early stage setting is also expanding. And I think it's extremely exciting, right? We're seeing all of this activity in the metastatic setting now translating into the curative setting. And I think this will have significant impact, and we're starting to see that impact. So this is a summary of the various approaches that are being tested in the early stage setting for advancing oral SERD or novel SERD therapy. And it really comes down to an upfront versus a switch strategy. Of course, our current approach, particularly for our higher risk patients, is endocrine-based therapy plus CDK4/6 inhibition, and then to continue on the endocrine monotherapy. So in terms of oral SERD development, trials are now testing either a switch strategy where you are on that endocrine therapy CDK4/6 inhibition for an allotted period of time, a couple of years, and then you switch to the oral SERD, or an upfront strategy either with or without a CDK4/6 inhibitor and starting that SERD right away. And I think this is interesting because, as I think you pointed out, Heather, in the early stage setting, we don't expect or anticipate there to be a high prevalence of ESR1 mutations, especially when before you've used an aromatase inhibitor or on a short time on that aromatase inhibitor. So I think we'll also get a lot of really interesting data about resistance mechanisms from the various trials going on in this space and when that ESR1 mutation emerges, and then the subsequent efficacy of the SERD in those various settings. Now, with that being said, we did see some, I would say, very exciting data from the LIDERA trial. This is really our first readout of an oral SERD trial in the early stage setting. So I'll just remind folks of the trial design here. So this was patients with stage 1 to 3 early stage breast cancer. Now one had to be high risk, and I'll point out some of the features there, or node positive disease. And patients were randomized upfront to giredestrant, novel oral SERD, or standard of care endocrine therapy, which could have been tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And a few things to point out here, as I mentioned, stage one high risk was allowed. Premenopausal patients were also eligible, and ovarian function suppression was required for premenopausal patients. In the standard of care arm, I mentioned either aromatase inhibition or tamoxifen were allowed, and we can talk about the implications of including both of those agents in the control arm. And then finally, interestingly, prior endocrine therapy with a CDK4/6 inhibitor for up to 12 weeks was allowed, but if that was the case, the CDK4/6 inhibitor had to be stopped upon randomization because that combination was not allowed during the trial. So here are the baseline characteristics of patients. You can see that about 40% of patients were premenopausal, and about 20% of patients were node negative. Here I'll highlight the population in the medium versus the high risk category. And there you can see about 70%, so a predominance of the population were in that high risk category, which was really defined by anatomic staging. Now let's take a look at the primary endpoint here, invasive disease-free survival, and ultimately it's really that hazard ratio that we have to pay attention to, because this is still a bit of an early look at the data here, but there you can see that the hazard ratio was 0.7, favoring giredestrant over standard of care endocrine therapy. And this is, these points were pointed out by the discussant, Lisa Carey, which I think are important to keep in mind here, that the curves do separate, even though we're waiting for longer term outcomes. And when we look at other key endpoints that support this primary endpoint, like distant recurrence-free survival, you see a consistent story as well. Now, one of the things that I don't have on the slide here is that when you parse out the control arm endocrine therapy, whether it was tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, you do see that that magnitude of benefit was even greater if you're comparing to tamoxifen. So you know, we do have to keep in mind that perhaps a little bit of a more inferior therapy in this moderate to high risk population could be contributing to some of this delta benefit that we're observing with giredestrant. The other key consideration here, of course, is tolerability. And I think one of the exciting things about the availability of oral SERDs or the development of oral SERDs in the early stage setting is that we know that patients do struggle, unfortunately, with adjuvant endocrine therapy. Many of them discontinue adjuvant endocrine therapy, certainly AIs due to arthralgia, weight gain, and other things. So another potential is the better tolerability of giredestrant in the early stage setting. So there you can see some summary points here that the rate of dose interruptions was slightly higher in the giredestrant arm compared to the control arm, but the rate of discontinuations was actually higher in the standard of care arm. And when you look specifically at arthralgia, interestingly, if you look down at the AE plot there, you can see that the rates of all grade arthralgia were similar between both arms, but the rates of discontinuation due to musculoskeletal symptoms was lower with giredestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy, 1.8% versus 4.4%. So this suggests to me that that clinically impactful arthralgia or musculoskeletal symptoms were likely to be lower in the giredestrant arm versus the standard of care arm. Also keeping in mind, again, the inclusion of tamoxifen, where you see less arthralgia in the control arm. And then finally, bradycardia is something that we think about with some of the oral SERDs. Fortunately, it was pretty uncommon here, 10% and largely grade 1 with giredestrant. So the summary for lidERA here is that ultimately, this is really our first advance in adjuvant endocrine therapy in the last two decades here. There was looking at that hazard ratio, there was a 30% proportional improvement in IDFS, as well as other cancer-specific endpoints telling a consistent story. And this is an early look that benefit, particularly in ER-positive primary disease is likely to grow as we continue to have longer-term follow-up. Now, what's also interesting here is that we don't have combination data with CDK4/6 inhibitors from the lidERA trial. That was not allowed. Dr. Carey suggested in her discussion that for our high-risk patients, we may consider AI plus CDK4/6 inhibition and then switching to giredestrant, but of course, this is not how the lidERA trial was designed. So I think one of the key questions there is, if we do take that approach, is there really an additive benefit, or should we stick with the evidence-based approach and start up front with giredestrant monotherapy?
In the final segment, Dr. MacArthur discusses important trial data and novel endocrine therapy approaches.
So let's talk about the two studies in this space, the phase 3 EMBER-3 study that was presented by Komal Jhaveri, who was just on this preceding panel, enrolled patients who had first-line aromatase inhibitor therapy. And you're going to be tempted to try and do cross-study comparisons between EMBER-3 and EMERALD, but I'm going to try and discourage you from doing that, because the patient populations are very different. So here, you had to have received first-line aromatase inhibitor therapy plus or minus CDK4/6 inhibitor. So CDK4/6 inhibitor exposure was not a required component or eligibility criteria for this study. Patients were enrolled to receive imlunestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy, which was either fulvestrant or exemestane. The study was modified during the course to allow for this third arm, and that's why you see that red box is sort of pushed over a little bit, because that was incorporated later on in the course of the study, and we'll talk about the data there. But that third arm allowed for imlunestrant together with abemaciclib, so CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy. Here are all the baseline characteristics. I think some of the most sort of notable ones are that pre- and postmenopausal women could enroll. The majority of women participating in the study were postmenopausal. The prevalence of ESR1 and PIK3CA mutations is what you would expect, which is about 40% for each of those mutations. Over half of patients had visceral disease. Most of the patients had secondary resistance to endocrine therapy. So this is not your patients who are the rapid progressors on endocrine therapy. Overall, almost 60% of patients had prior CDK4/6. So again, this is a distinguishing feature that we'll mention in the context of the EMERALD study, where everyone was required to have prior CDK4/6. Here, only about 60% or just under 60% of patients received CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy. And given the era in which the study was conducted, the majority of patients received palbociclib as their CDK4/6, which may not represent a current standard of care. So here you see the imlunestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy progression-free survival in the ESR1 mutated population. There was a notable improvement with a hazard ratio of 0.62. Improvement in progression-free survival. You can see the response rates here and the clinical benefit rates. Survival data was immature, but it was a very notable, especially that landmark analysis. I always think these studies are super interesting because those first couple months, the patients who are going to do very poorly very quickly, right? So it's really after the first 2 to 3 months where those curves really start to separate, but a very notable benefit seen there. The benefit was very consistent across all of the subgroups interrogated, maybe with the exception of exemestane-treated patients. So again, physicians were allowed to choose fulvestrant or exemestane, and I think it speaks to sort of our bias around what patients should receive after progression on a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor, and we could debate that all day, but very consistent benefits across all of the subgroups interrogated, including those who did or did not receive a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. Safety and tolerability, so very well tolerated regimen. I'm going to focus here just on the imlunestrant versus standard of care endocrine therapy, which is the table on the left. And it's imlunestrant as monotherapy, which is currently approved. We'll circle back on the combination in a second. but very well tolerated in my mind, with less than 20% grade 3 or higher events. So you can see here, less than 1% fatigue, less than 1% diarrhea, et cetera, et cetera. Very low discontinuation rates, you can't dose change exemestane or fulvestrant, so that's not really a fair kind of assessment in my mind, but very well tolerated. So that was all EMBER-3. Emerald, which was presented prior to EMBER-3, so Emerald is a phase 3 study that enrolled postmenopausal women and men, primarily postmenopausal women who had progressed on prior endocrine therapy. They had to have received prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. So there's a difference in the eligibility criteria in terms of allowance of premenopausal, which was allowed on EMBER-3, but not here. This is all postmenopausal. And again, about 60% of patients on EMBER-3 had prior CDK. Here, 100% of patients had prior CDK because that was part of the eligibility criteria. And patients were randomized to receive physician's choice of endocrine therapy versus elacestrant. And very consistent patient populations here. I just pointed out that just over 20%. So you were allowed on this study to have a prior line of chemotherapy, which you were not allowed on EMBER-3. So again, this is a slightly more heavily pretreated. So I just keep honing on these points because it is really an apples and oranges kind of comparison. They really can't be directly compared. And here, again, over 20% of patients had prior chemotherapy, which is interesting to me because how often do we go back to an endocrine approach after chemotherapy? It's a little unusual. And here is the data for, on the left, all patients, progression-free survival, the primary endpoint, and the co-primary endpoint on the right, patients with ESR1 mutations. So you can see that there was an improvement in progression-free survival for the intention-to-treat population, but it was magnified for the ESR1 mutation population. PFS, 3.8 versus 1.9 months. So it just speaks again to this space where with the standard of care, the best PFS or the average PFS was only 1.9 months. So again, it just underscores in my mind how much work we have to do in this space. But a doubling in PFS with a related hazard ratio. And then we saw some subgroup analysis, post hoc subgroup analysis, looking at prior exposure to CDK4/6 inhibitors, patients who had more durable responses, not surprisingly, to their first line CDK4/6 inhibitor did better, which isn't hugely provocative. I mean, people who don't, who progress on first-line therapy very quickly don't tend to do well on subsequent lines of therapy, and that's what we saw here. Those who had 12 or more months of prior CDK4/6 inhibitor did better. Biomarker analyses, so here we're looking at ESR1 mutation and PIK3CA co-mutation, so that happens in about 16% of patients, so 40%. Prevalence ESR1 mutations, 40%, PIK3CA mutations, and that intersection is just under 20%. And you see very consistent benefits regardless of that mutation status, including those who had HER2 low disease. What about toxicity? So again, nausea is uncommon. This is a very well tolerated, in my mind, regimen, and interested now that you all have had experience with this drug, but in my hands, very, very well tolerated. They've shared this this toxicity data with us, the rare high-grade nausea, very infrequently leading to dose reductions or discontinuations. I personally have had no issues prescribing this medication and haven't had any nausea to manage. So again, these two studies, EMBER-3, different patient populations, postmenopausal versus pre and post, requirement of CDK4/6 in EMERALD, not required in EMBER-3, and the allowance in EMERALD of the prior chemotherapy, so maybe a more heavily pretreated population. So here are exactly what I said we shouldn't do, which is cross-study comparisons. But again, it just points out that they're very different populations, and we shouldn't probably show these Kaplan-Meiers on the same page for that exact same reason, because again, they're very different populations. And you can see that represented in the standard of care arms here, right? 1.9 months in Emerald versus 3.8 months in Ember-3, indicating that there's some selection differences, which hopefully I've underscored. What I think was interesting in Ember-3 was the combination arm of imlunestrin and abemaciclib. And I would just point out here that the PFS primary endpoint demonstrated an improvement compared with standard of care and compared with imlunestrant here. That's what you're seeing here, the combination of imlunestrant and abema versus imlunestrant alone. And there was a 41% reduction in risk of progression. It was very consistent across the subgroups. And interestingly, it was agnostic of ESR1 mutation status.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.